So continuing with Hanbury Brown on 26 August 76. So you were saying about these strange radio sources.
Oh, well, we didn't know whether the things were stars or whether they were nebulae or whether they were galactic or whether they were extragalactic. And, of course, by some strange freak of nature, they conspired to look as though they were galactic, because the two main radio stars in the sky, as far as the Northern Hemisphere was concerned, were Cassiopeia and Cygnus.
Right.
And they were both in the galactic plane, and so we thought, well, they must be galactic objects. And, of course, we were wrong, because then it turned out that one was a galactic object, the other wasn't. It was just by luck that it was in the plane.
Right.
And, in fact, it was Tommy Gold at a meeting of the Royal Astronomical Society who got up and said he thought that they might be extragalactic. And I think both Ryle and I got up and said that's absolute nonsense, because obviously they're both in the galactic plane, and therefore they're both, it's very likely that they're galactic.
Right, right.
Tommy was right and we were wrong. But we were very interested in this, so I decided early on that the thing to do was to measure their angular diameter and settle whether or not they were stars or not. Because we used to call them radio stars, and
this term radio star has a definite slant to it already, right? I mean, as soon as you call them that, you're thinking of a local population of small objects.
Yes, and Cambridge people published a lot of things saying that their density was one per cubic light year or
whatever,
something or other.
Right,
some number which is pretty
less sure about really what they what they were.
Yes, I thought that the thing to do was to measure their angular size, and so I started the program of angular diameter measuring at Jodrell Bank, which carried on from the time I started it to the present day.
Right. Yeah, well,
continuously.
I talked with Henry Palmer and Rose.
And I had an uphill job to keep it going, too. It's, they're very proud of it now and all that sort of thing, but there was a time when one had to talk very hard to sustain that program, actually.
Now, would you say it's fair to say that this program began with the intensity interferometer?
No. I find that very difficult to remember. The answer is, I think it did begin with the intensity interferometer. I think it did. We decided to measure the two brightest radio stars in the sky, Cygnus and Cassiopeia, and we built this radio interferometer. Yes. That's in my book. I can't really in detail remember the history of it, but we built one to measure the diameter of the sun first, and showed that the thing worked, and then we measured the diameter of Cygnus and Cassiopeia with it.
Okay, well, you're skipping over some rather vital...
But I'm a little bit forgotten, but the main program of angular diameter measuring was started with a 220-foot paraboloid, and the people who helped me there was A.R. Thompson, who's now working in America. I think he's concerned with the VLA.
He's just been made head of the whole
electronics. And he was a student. And then there was Palmer, and who came from Oxford, I think, on atmospheric electricity work he'd been doing.
Right.
And somebody else who I can't remember. And we decided to measure the angular size of the radio stars that we were detecting with the 220-foot paraboloid. And we started off with an interferometer with a very short baseline of a few hundred yards and gradually got further and further away. Until, of course, in the end, we were sort of 100 miles away. But we started with 100 yards, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
That was the program that carried on ever since.
But now I'm still a little confused about the relation of this conventional interferometry program with the intensity interferometer. Did they sort of begin together? Did the other only begin when you realized that the intensity interferometer was only good for the strongest sources?
Yes, well, I find that very hard to answer. I'd have to look at the original scientific paper to see what the dates were. I think
maybe it'll be apparent when I go back to the papers.
Yes, I can't say which came before the other, but I simply cannot remember.
In any case, they were both directed towards the same end.
It's all part of the same story of trying to find the angular size. I can't remember now from memory. I think that the intensity interferometer came first. Yes, I think it did.
Well, certainly the idea for it came first, according to how you write in your book.
I think it must come first, and then I think we built the radio one first, I think, and measured signals in Cassiopeia. And then we decided to, sort of almost simultaneously, I think, to measure the radio stars on detected by the 220-foot dish. And we built a special interferometer to do that, a thing called a rotating lobe interferometer.
That's right.
And
how did this idea come to you?
Oh, I don't know. I just thought of it, I think. That was very great. Great fun in those days because almost everything, all the problems were so new that, it was much more fun, so to speak, because you could... We weren't using quite as big equipment, and it wasn't so expensive equipment, and so you could build a thing and try it, mm-hmm. and nowadays it's a much bigger process.
It involves many more people.
I built a polarimeter to measure the polarization of some radio stars early on, for example, using a radio aerial which was on the Schott Tower in the London in that big exhibition, what's it called, you remember, Festival of Britain, and...
That's right, Henry Palmer told me.
That sort of thing one could build oneself and do the experiment in a few months and so on. It was very, very nice stage in the science.
Once again, I can ask for a transition date. When did the science sort of change its...
Well, I would say that the work that we did on the 220-foot dish showed the possibilities of a big paraboloid. That's mm-hmm. what it did. In fact, it showed the possibilities. Astrophysically speaking, apart from the Andromeda Nebula and the detection of the supernova, the Cygnus loop and so on, the results were all right, but the main thing was they showed the potentialities of a really steerable dish. Mm-hmm. And therefore they formed a sort of observational support or basis for the idea of building a 250-foot paraboloid. In other words, the 250-foot paraboloid would never have got off the ground if there hadn't been the preliminary work with the 220-foot paraboloid to show what you could do.
Right. And did you yourself think that this was a good idea to have a fully steerable?
Yes.
Large dish?
Yes. I did. I helped Bernard Lovell promote it and so on. And as it went ahead, of course, I realized... I was in Australia, actually, in 1952 at the time, and hydrogen line, one began to appreciate the importance of the hydrogen line.
Right.
And we had designed the initial specifications of the 250-foot dish to go down to about a meter wavelength, because we thought that was a reasonably high frequency limit. And when I was in Australia, I realized how important it was that it should go down to hydrogen line. I remember sending him a cable, Bernard Lovell a cable, saying that, whatever we did, we'd have to change it and make it go on the hydrogen line.
I see. And did that considerably add to the cost of that?
Yeah, I think it did. I don't know what the official story of the thing is, but in point of fact, it actually did. I might have to read the official story to tell you what the proper...
Wait, I've heard that.
But that's actually what happened.
But of course, that has been an important part of this program.
Yes, indeed it
years.
Has. Yes. And of course, the cost went on going up, and the price of steel went on going up. And this was... It was when that thing was made that the science changed from something, which was in the early stages and where you could do things by yourself and with comparatively little money into a sort of institutionalized large thing.
Right.
The scale of things is appalling. I mean, you can build the effective scale. For example, you can build, a 72-inch telescope, and it's a telescope which you can just go and unlock the door and go and use, right?
Right.
You build a 150-inch telescope, and you've got an institution. You've got a place with secretaries and staircases and offices and...
But why does that happen? I mean,
why does it happen? It happens. It's a question of scale.
I mean, is it a question of the sort of the annual budget needed?
Well, for example, take the work we did originally, of course. I mean, working with a sort of 80-foot or something like that, radio telescope, something like that, then it's okay. But the 250-foot telescope, it had to have full-time controllers and navals. Commanders in charge of it, and God knows, regulations, and And it's at that point, I don't like that sort of thing, because I'm an experimental person, and once you've built a big thing like that, you can't easily change it.
Yeah. But in this, it would seem to me that the same thing must have happened when you went to Australia with your intensity interferometer. That was a pretty large project itself.
It was a fairly large project, yes, it was, and it took a great deal of my life to make it work. Quite true, yes. That's true, too.
But
yes, I know.
Was it still small enough, or are you saying that it didn't quite become an institution?
Yes,
Narrabri is not quite an institution?
No, it was still small enough that it could be a personal matter.
Yeah.
Yes. The scale was...
How many people have been on your staff in the first years, anyway, at Narrabri?
In Australia?
Yeah.
Oh, I suppose there were about five or six of us on it, and then there was, for the first year, we had two electrical people doing the wiring, and we had a team of erection engineers for putting the thing together.
It's hardly what you would call an institution, though, right?
No, it's not an institution, no. Finally, we used to be able to run it with three people.
Now, what about the contrast between the styles of working at Jodrell Bank and Cambridge? Also, in the late 50s, Cambridge had to go institutional, so to speak, by... it was really the early 60s, I guess, by getting the Muldred Observatory and all this sort of thing. But nevertheless, I think that through the 50s, there's a bit of a difference in emphasis of a more of a general purpose.
Jodrell Bank was a more varied technical, less concentrated on the single astronomical objective and very much more varied technically.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bigger emphasis on... Well, you see, we went in for radar as well as radio astronomy.
That's right.
And that involves you in a lot of machinery. And we use electrical engineers to do that.
Right.
In fact, J.V. Evans and, I've forgotten the man's name, Moran, and those people who did the first echoes from the moon there, they were electrical engineers. So there was rather a strong electrical engineering bias at Jodrell. And there was a greater variety of work and smaller groups engaged in a variety of works, like ionospheric winds and moon echoes and, I can't remember now all the things.
Well, the meteor radar, of course.
Yes, meteor radar and meteor photography and, there was quite a variety of things. And Cambridge was more concentrated on the objective of radio stars.
Yeah.
In other words, they concentrated on radio stars.
They did a few other things, but certainly
they
majority,
did some other things
majority
as well. They did indeed.
Stars,
they did some solar work, for example.
Well, that ended though before the. Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's not right. You had.
But we had things like magnetic field observations and things like that at Jodrell. There's a lot of other things, you see.
The Earth's magnetic field.
Well, we were observing that as well. With the sensitive magnetometers and things like that. There's a variety of things going on there.
So it really wouldn't be proper to call it a radio astronomy station. It was more a radio techniques or anything that radio techniques could be used for.
Meteor, I don't know what you call meteor radar. When I first went there, the meteor radar was the main thing. There wasn't any what you call cosmic radio wave reception.
But what I mean is that there were other things even besides any kind of astronomy. There was ionospheric work using a magnetometer for the Earth's magnetic field.
Yes.
People
true.
That were mainly interested in engineering.
Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't really care about what the shape of the moon's surface was.
No, that's quite true. There was a difference, I think, in that respect, but,
I think that's quite right, whereas Cambridge has been much more interested in the astronomical results. Well, the intensity interferometer, you mentioned it just very briefly before. Can you tell me, it raised quite a ruckus later on about the theory of it, but... It seems like, from what you say in your book, that it was pretty clear to you from all the way through that the thing had to work, and there was no doubt about it.
Well, the reason why we knew it had to work was this, that I designed it originally as a radio instrument. This is the basic point. And we thought entirely in terms of radio waves, in terms of Fourier analysis, and, cross-beat terms of detectors and all that stuff, which I'm very familiar with.
Right.
And I thought exactly how it worked, and that it must work, and it did work, and there was no question. But it was when we applied it to optics that the question of photons was raised. And, of course, one didn't know enough quantum mechanics to be able to treat the thing quantum mechanically, although Kahn, Franz Kahn at Manchester, did it for me. but I didn't really understand it, and one had residual doubts about things like time delays in the photoelectric process and a whole lot of things like this, you know, and which one couldn't see from a photon point of view, because whenever you try to think in light, problems in light in terms of photons, you get into a hopeless muddle. And but all the time one knew that because it worked with waves, radio waves, then by the principle of what's it called, complementarity or something, you know, it must go smoothly over into the quantum region.
Yeah, yeah.
And the real problem was, what is the signal noise ratio when you have, it'll work, but what's the signal noise ratio? That was the problem which I was always slightly uncertain about. And this did involve knowing a bit more about physics and quantum theory.
You mean in particular
really
when you
did.
Wanted to take it to the optical?
Yes.
In the radio, were you pretty clear about the signal noise? Even before you began?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Well, it's all
you
worked
work
out fully,
out,
yes.
Yeah.
It's all in Phil Mag.
In that Phil Mag article.
Yes,
54.
It's all there. We were absolutely sure of our ground on the radio side.
Yeah.
I'm a professional radio engineer, and Richard Twist knew his stuff very well, and we had no doubts about that. But when we came to the physics of the quanta and the photons, so then we did have doubts.
I think actually at the end of that 54 article, you do sound a bit disparaging.
Yes,
say, well,
yes,
it probably won't work optically.
Yes, we said we didn't think, because we thought photon noise would do it in. That's quite true. Well, you see, that shows that we hadn't worked out signal noise ratio.
Right. But now,
we didn't see how to actually for quite a long time.
What made you want to take this over to the, I mean, after all, you've been working in radio for 20 years. What made you want to take this over to optical?
Well, it was, in fact, just that, the fact that we discovered that it would work through the scintillating ionosphere. I mean, that was an observation made at Jodrell Bank. When the thing was actually running, and the radio stars were going through it, and the ionosphere was making the radio stars scintillating, the thing was still working. And we stood in front of the recorder one day, and we said, look, the thing is scintillating like mad, this thing's working through the scintillations, why is it that it works all right when it's scintillating? And, you know, we worked out the theory and showed that it would work through the scintillations, as a matter of fact, and then we saw why, and we said, my God, if that is so, then you can make an optical interferometer which will work through atmospheric scintillations, and that cracks the major problem in developing optical interferometers. And, of course, Michelson's work on star diameters always has had a fascination for, I don't know why, it had a fascination for me, anyhow. And the idea of extending it and carrying it on was very attractive. And so there was a way of doing it. So I said, well, let's go ahead and do it. And,
still not clear to me how a radio engineer working at Jodrell for several years immediately jumps over to the optical. I mean, I can see you're thinking of it, but to actually commit yourself to this.
Rather a painful thing to do. But,
or at what stage did you really commit yourself to it? I suppose not until you've made a test.
Well,
thing.
I said I will make a pilot plant here and try this idea out, and if it really works, then we'll have to think about whether or not we make a full-scale instrument. And in fact, I built that thing with two searchlights and measured the angular diameter of Sirius. And the thing, this was terribly hard work, by the way, that was. And,
what were the problems?
The problems were that in order to get 18 hours of clear seeing of Sirius in Manchester, I had to sit up the whole 60 nights. And I was the only person running the equipment, and as we were running controlled searchlights as the mirrors, you started off by starting a diesel engine which supplied, you know. And I did it all by myself. But, you get interested in a thing like that, you know. And once you've got interest in it, you're hooked in it, and you go on with the momentum. I mean, you know the definition, people say, what is science? And you say, well, science is what I'm doing, you know, science is what I do, you know, that joke, there's a great deal of truth in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is one reason, actually, as a matter of fact. I'd been in radio as a radio engineer professionally since 1936. Which is a long time. The development of radar was very intensive, radio engineering. I'd had enough of it. And the construction of the 250-foot paraboloid and that big instrument is not really my cup of tea.
Yeah.
You see, although it was the right way for the sounds to go, of it, stuff to build this big instrument.
Yeah.
I personally am not attracted by using a big instrument. I want to paddle my own canoe.
Yeah, like I say, you want to have this small group.
Yeah, I want to paddle my own canoe a bit. Yeah. That's selfishness a bit, but... I mean, all these people have been selfish.
We're all selfish.
Well, I think all the leaders in the field of anyhow in our science have all been pretty selfish, in my opinion.
So this provided an opportunity where you could actually
extend
the radio work, and yet get into something that was every bit as fascinating as the radio work.
Oh yes, intensely interesting field. I mean, in a sense, optical astronomy is the bigger field, you see, really.
Would you care to elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the majority of our information about the stars and the origin of the structure of the universe, I mean, and stars and what stars are made of and the origin of the elements and the solar system and all these things that, you know, make up the corpus of astronomical knowledge have come through optics. Most of them.
But do you think that's something fundamental, or just a matter that radio astronomy has only been around for a while?
Not fundamental, no. Maybe it's just because radio astronomy hasn't been around for so long.
Yeah.
But also, of course, in the optical region, spectroscopy is an extremely rich subject, for example. Optical spectroscopy, very rich, huh?
Well, but now, of course, the radio is...
Yes, but I doubt whether we'll ever gain as much information as we shall on the optical through the radio channel.
That's a debatable point, but anyway...
Yes, a debatable point, yeah. Anyhow, what I'm saying is that it's a big pond,
yeah,
and I was attracted by the idea of cracking a classical problem.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than working out the details of or going on with what I've been doing. I was out there, I saw a classical problem which had not been cracked, which is how to measure the angular diameter of stars. You see, when I started on this game, no one had ever measured the angular diameter of a main sequence star.
Yeah.
Michelson had done six.
They were all giants.
Yeah. And that's a challenging problem for someone who's interested in instruments.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was primarily interested in instruments.
Right. But still, here was a basic contribution that could be made to the science, of course.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, very respectable. that's why I did it.
Now, when you built this first searchlight thing to test it, were there unexpected problems in
the... The problems were screening from interference. It's a terribly sensitive thing. Drift in the correlator. Yes, there were. There was icing up of mirrors in the winter, big mirrors, all sorts of minor things which, you have to... they're all technical questions, which were invaluable in the design of a big instrument at Narrabri, yes.
Right.
But there were no problems of basic fundamental problems at all.
Mm-hmm.
We had covered the science completely.
And so you were not surprised that when you finally got it working?
No, we knew it had to work, really.
Yeah. How long did that take?
Oh.
That must have been a rather happy occasion when you got your...
The original thing with a searchlight?
Yes, right.
It took months. To build it, of course, took about a year, that's all.
Yeah.
But to make it work... Ah, yes, it was happy, but... It took about 6 months to make the measurements, I think.
Yeah. Well, then it wasn't actually something that you were there and you could see you'd done it. It was something that...
There isn't a moment when you sort of say, ha, works,
Right.
It's anxious to the last minute.
You had to integrate over the
whole. Yes, you had to analyze the results, plot them all, and so, but, well, halfway through, it's working all right. There's no one evening where you say, good, that's marvelous, it works.
Right. Now, I'm not able to there's many articles you have from 54 through... 60, and I would propose that we could perhaps cover those in a short session after I'm able to look at those some other day.
Sorry?
But let's just continue this line with the Narrabri interferometer. The optical intensity interferometer.
Yeah.
It obviously apparently got your attention more and more. And,
yeah.
And it was clear, I guess, that you had to go somewhere other than England.
Yeah. Yes. Heavens, yes.
And so was Australia the obvious choice, or did you think of other places?
No, not obvious at all, actually. As a matter of fact, we want to put it in Provence. Not at all, obviously.
So you could stay stationed at Jodrell still?
It was clear that the thing couldn't go in England, because you only get about 30 good nights or whatever it is a year in parts in Edinburgh, for example, and the seeing down in Hurstminster is, not clear enough anywhere. Yeah. Maybe St Andrews would be marginally all right, but I don't think so. Anyhow, we decided that we want to put a good site, so we in fact designed it for possibility of going to Haute-Provence in France.
Mm-hmm.
And about this time, Richard Twiss went to work in Australia with the CSIRO on a research fellowship, working on a radio interferometer, I think, with Christensen, I'm not quite sure about that. And also about the same time, it began to be clear that the instrument was going to cost a great deal more than we thought. And Professor Blackett had told me that he would be prepared to back the funding of anything up to about 50,000 or something pounds, and it was obviously going to cost more than twice that. So we were looking for money, and Richard Twiss found the money in Australia.
In
the form of a promise from Harry Messel to give us a site, pay half the capital cost, and pay all the running costs. So we thought, well, that's fine. Send it out to Australia, and that'll solve the problem. And I thought, well, I'll go out there for 2 years and make the thing work, and then leave it with Twiss. And he can run it out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out there, and about the time I went out there, he decided to come back and live in London. So Harry Messel would then be stuck with an instrument, an extremely complicated instrument, with no one to look after it.
Yeah.
And so there was no alternative. I had to stay. That's why I stayed in Australia. So I never came back. Although I was on the staff of Manchester for 2 years.
After you left?
Yes. And then we decided, the Vice-Chancellor and I, that couldn't really go on like that forever.
Yeah.
That's right. So I had to give up radio astronomy. I didn't really want to entirely. I would like to have gone on and done partly optical and partly radio.
I see. What sort of radio were you thinking that would be fruitful?
I was going to encourage the problem of optical combination. I always had this idea of that England and particularly and so on, that our work was weak in the cooperation between the optical work and the radio work. I could see certain optical lines which I felt could be developed to help the radio lines, and one of them was the image intensifier way back for spectroscopy. And there were a number of things that I wanted to do, narrow band filter photography, for example. And as an example of that, I went to the Picton Midi, for example, shortly before I went to Australia and took some photographs of the Northern Spur thing, you know, radio feature in the Northern Hemisphere, with a 12 angstrom bandwidth optical filter. I mean, that was just the start of the program work which I wanted to do on collaboration between optics and radio.
I see.
But of course, it never came to anything. That's what I would have done.
Yeah, yeah. But why not in Australia? I mean, has it just been too much time?
Oh, well, that's simply because the narrowband interferometer is a full-time job, more than a full-time job, and hardest job I've ever done or ever will do.
Yeah.
It's a tremendously exhausting, demanding job.
Well, it took how many years?
Enormous amount. I did 160 nights observing in 1 year.
Jeez.
Not many people do
too
that.
Many clear
Some people
there.
Don't do it in their whole life.
Right.
Still, it was worth it.
Oh, I know that has. Why was it that it ended up costing somewhat more than the your original estimates on the...
Everything does. No specific reason. Everything does. One reason was that a lot of the initial estimates were made by Richard Twiss. In point of fact, that's true. The site costs were estimated by Richard Twiss. And Richard Twiss is a very good mathematical physicist, but he's hopeless at
real estate.
Hopeless at estimating. I don't think he would be now, but he was in those days. And he underestimated them terribly.
I see.
The site costs were the worst thing. I mean, they were sort of 10 times what he estimated, or 5 times or something like that.
Yeah.
Of course, that's part of the process of scientific development of large instruments. If you estimate what a large instrument is going to cost right off the button at the beginning, of course you never get it built.
Right, that's right.
The 250-foot dish was built like this.
Part of the game.
It's
yeah.
part of the game. Yes, yeah. It's a strategic underestimating. But it wasn't intentional. It never is intentional.
This is a bit off my topic, since I'm sticking to radio astronomy before the early 60s, but still, having you here and wanting to make an archive of sort of these tapes, I feel compelled to ask you about looking back after, 15 years at the Narrabri.
Yes.
You've written a book which 14 years, yes. says much of what you believe, but I'd still be interested in your comments on what it has accomplished. Has it done what you wanted it to do and so forth?
Yes. Yes, it did. It took longer than we wanted it to take, because there were other things that I would like to have done, but we did what we had to do very thoroughly. In other words, it measured the angular diameter of a range of stars, from spectral type O down to spectral type F, and a number of main sequence stars, and this has never been done before. Mm-hmm. We have very good reasons to believe the results are completely reliable. We have combined these results with the University of Wisconsin, with the OAO ultraviolet spectral distributions of all these stars, and our own spectrophotometry, which we did ourselves. John Davis did it, actually. And we have produced the first entirely experimental, what I call empirical, temperature scale for stars. That's quite a step.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be a spectacular step, a step in astronomy in which this temperature scale of the stars is not based on any model theory at all.
Right.
It's entirely experimental. And it involves ultraviolet survey from above the Earth's atmosphere and the measurement of angular size. They're both jolly difficult.
In order to get the total luminosity?
Yes, to get the total luminosity and the angular size, you combine them to get the effective temperature.
Right.
And this is the first time it's ever been done. Now, that paper's in the Astrophysical Journal, and if I had to just leave one thing behind, that would be enough.
Even more so than the Phil Magg paper from 54, for
instance. Oh, well, maybe, but I don't know. But anyhow, it's a nice brick to put in the building of astronomy.
Yeah,
And the next thing is that, of course, I did a lot of other experiments on binary stars and rotating stars and things, but I want to show how high resolution, angular resolution interferometry can be applied to optical astronomy. I want to show that. And then people will go ahead and do it. And that's exactly what's happening now.
Right.
We'll find now that a large number of people doing this game. They're trying to get into the business that I was pointed towards. Like, for example, measuring the angular size of pulsating stars, measuring the shape of rotating stars, measuring binary stars, measuring,
You're referring to like speckle interferometry and...
Well, any form of high-resolution angular interferometry. The application of it to astronomy.
Yeah, yeah.
You see, I sustained it in radio work successfully and kept that program going, and people like Palmer and other people like that have done a good job. I wanted to do it in optics as well. Michelson started it. I wanted to take it on.
Right. Although... I think in radio
he couldn't take it very far because he went on to another job, and anyhow, he couldn't see how to take the next step. I saw a new way of taking the next step.
Yeah.
Right? I don't say that the next step now is the same thing. It doesn't necessarily mean that the next step is to develop the intensity interferometer. I wouldn't argue that for a moment. But that was a tool to show what could be done.
Yeah.
I don't actually happen to think that the next step is the intensity interferometer. I believe that we should now develop the very modernized form of Michelson's interferometer. That's what I'm doing at the moment in Australia.
You think it's fair to say, though, that if you had not done this this first interferometry that led to LBI and so forth, that would have gone along in radio pretty naturally, because radio people are just thinking that way. But on the other hand, if you'd not given the spur to the optical interferometry, that might well have not been spurred. I mean, in other words, that your service has been greater to optical astronomy in that respect.
I think that might be true, yes.
Yeah.
And I think that even Laborie, for example, if you asked him, he would probably tell you that he took an interest in the problem of angular size after reading some of the stuff that I've written and saying how important it was. I think he said that somewhere in an article. I'm not suggesting that, but I think it has been a stimulus. But the thing that actually did stimulate the work, funnily enough, is not so much entirely in astronomy, but it's in physics, actually. The work that we did in order to sort out the theory of the intensity interferometer was the work on the correlation between photons and the what you call the correspondence between the quantum picture and the what is called the semi-classical treatment, or the semi-classical treatment of the problem of the detection of coherence and partially coherent fields.
Between two independent...
The work that I did on this business of the correlation between photons in coherent beams of light, which was the experiments we did at Jodrell Bank, taking a long-term view, is the in terms of a contribution to the theory of light and the stimulus to a whole field of laboratory physics and theoretical physics of coherent and semi-coherent, you know, all that business and quantum, what they call quantum optics and so on. It did stimulate that field very greatly.
Well, I wasn't aware of that.
That's probably, in some ways, its biggest effect, really, which has been in physics, in the physics of coherent.
I've heard it said, and I think I would agree, that the primary contribution to physics that radio astronomy has made, maybe the quasars or pulsars who ultimately went out, but anyway, so far has been indeed your intensity interferometer, which started as a radio thing and then went to optical.
Yes, well, it made a, it did but make a significant contribution to the theory of coherence.
But you're saying that
light,
it wasn't just in that it's in solving one problem in debate in the late 50s, but it sort of opened up a whole
It stimulated a whole field of activity, which is called quantum optics.
Can you tell me a little bit about this debate? I've looked somewhat at these papers in Nature and such in the late 50s, flying back and forth. It gets a bit confusing, but was it sort of the old guard that couldn't accept...
No, not really. It was just a conceptual problem. The problem is that the main thing is simply that physicists are brought up on... particle theory and so on, you know, protons, electrons, photons, and all that sort of thing. They think that they understand light, of course, and at least they think they did. and of course, the photon is the most difficult way of thinking about light there is, and you know, actually.
Well, in some cases, it's simpler. I mean,
yeah, but I mean,
that's how the whole concept came about, of course, the photoelectric effect.
Yes, but you read Dirac's books. And you'll see that they wrestled with the problems of the conceptual problems of the photon are very obscure. If you try and think about light in terms of photons, you nearly always come to the wrong answer. I mean, this is really true.
Yeah.
You know, you start all the stupid thing about it goes through a polarimeter, is it in one state of polarization, is it in another state of polarization? How does a photon go through two holes at once and manage to know where it's going to land on the screen? You see, all this conceptual sort of barriers it introduces. Yeah. You see, there's a whole set of ridiculous... problems, whereas in fact most of these problems, if you think of them in terms of Maxwell's equations and waves, I mean, you know, you can see the answer.
But why do we have photons then?
Well, you, strictly speaking, don't need them for nearly all phenomena, which are, for example, you don't need photons as a concept to explain the photoelectric effect, although in the books it tells you that you do, you don't. I mean, there's a very beautiful article by Lamb and Willis Lamb and forgotten the other man's name. On it's in the birthday volume that was written for Kastler's 60th birthday. The volume's called Polarisation Matière, something like that. Anyhow, there's an article in there called Photoelectric Effect Without Photons. Which shows you how to get the photoelectric effect. But the dodge there is that you represent the light wave by Maxwell's equations, and then you have a quantized detector. The quantization's in the detector. And this, of course, is the important point, which people tend to overlook. You see, the quantization that you associate with the photon, usually, is, roughly speaking, usually, in all these problems, is in the detector. The detector process, detecting process is quantized, and the transmitting process is quantized. It's when you start thinking about the transmission process as being quantized that you go wrong. And that's what you don't want to do, and that's what these boys do, you see. They think of the photon in flight. And that's what we get all the wrong answers. And that's, we had a lot of trouble.
But am I not right in saying that there were some pretty eminent physicists?
Oh, yes, I've got some letters from Berkeley and some of the big laboratories in America. One of them signed by 5 people, or all of them, well, most of them quite well known now.
Saying that this just could not be.
Yes, saying that this is contrary, yes.
And therefore saying that there must be something wrong with your experiment.
In fact, I got a whole bunch of letters from people all over the world saying this is wrong. That's why Purcell wrote that letter of Nature.
Right.
He wrote it in order to, you know, help defend.
But, I mean, was the implication of all these was, well, theory says it cannot be, therefore your experiment, you must have gone wrong somewhere.
Oh, yes. Yes, and right, in fact, there were right. 2 experiments done to show that, in fact, the experiments didn't give the answer that we had. One done by Janoszy in Hungary, and the other one done by Brannon and Ferguson in Canada. And they both repeated my experiment and showed that there was no correlation.
And any idea where they went wrong? Or?
Oh, yes. We published a paper showing where they go wrong. They didn't have a proper quantitative theory of the thing. And there were things like bandwidth and light bandwidth and ray and electrical bandwidth and all those sort of things that were wrong.
I see. And when was this paper published? That you
Nature? Oh, I don't know.
You correcting theirs was in Nature also, I see.
Yes, we showed that they would have... it was slightly venomous, the paper we wrote, a little bit.
Well, I
think we ended up saying that one of them would have to have observed for 10th to 11th years, which is unfortunately rather long than the age of the Earth.
Not for the age of the universe,
mildly
maybe.
Mildly sarcastic paper, but still, you know. I was very irritated with these people. It was fun. It was all fun. It was all good fun. Then we had a controversy with Felge over the subject, Clark Jones over the subject of a very interesting little problem in thermodynamics about the fluctuations in temperature of a grey body. That was quite good, you know. They pointed out that our formula didn't give the right fluctuations in the temperature of a grey body in a cavity, in an isothermal cavity, and we managed to unwind that one too. And the answer is the classical formulation in the books on thermodynamics treats the what's called the received and the emitted stream of radiation from a body in a cavity as being statistically independent.
Yeah.
And in fact, they're not, because they're connected through stimulated emission.
Oh, yeah.
And when you put the stimulated emission term in, you get the right answer, which is the answer that we got, you see. And that took some time to find out what was wrong. I know it was silly, but it is one of the controversies. No, really, actually, as a matter of fact, all this business about photons, correlation, and the representation between the semi-classical representation, the Maxwell representation, and the proper quantum representation, right, stimulated a great deal of work.
Oh, yeah, I can see it.
There are masses of papers on this topic.
But you're saying that...
Quantum optics.
But even a wider topic...
well, you see, we could have applied the intensity interferometer to spectroscopy. And we just happened to use it for a particular thing. You know, there are other things that could have been done. Actually, I don't think there's much practical application there, but we didn't explore that.
Yeah.
But other people went off and explored all these things. I've lost touch with it.
Yeah.
Complicated mathematically.
I meant to ask you before, when you're talking about your measuring of stars in the main sequence and such, did the temperature scale you come up with differ very much from...
Not much, no. Not much. No, but you know, they fuss about such details nowadays in temperature scale. It differs a bit,
But it didn't change things drastically. Which,
oh, no. Which it establishes the temperature up in the hot part much more securely. Up in the B, you know, B1 to up there. It establishes that a bit more securely. There's always been a good deal of doubt about those temperatures.
Okay,
not
well.
I'm not sure even now. I mean, there's a problem with extended atmospheres. There's a great deal to be done. There would be an enormous lot for a more sensitive interferometer to do.
Yeah.